How many of you have taken linear algebra? Okay, so most people. Okay, cool. So if I do something that maybe you don't remember, or if I say something that, without backing it up, feel free to stop me, and because I'm not entirely sure like what things you saw and what you haven't seen. So I'm going to be talking today about Fourier series, which is, I guess, a very specific thing in Fourier analysis. So Fourier analysis is basically the study of the Fourier transform. And, oh yeah, another thing that I'm going to be doing is maybe like writing on the side, just I might word drop or theorem drop just to get you, you know, some, give you something to look up afterwards and that kind of stuff. So yeah, Fourier analysis is basically the study of the Fourier transform, and everything I'm talking about today is going to be looking at the Fourier transform. So it's the Fourier transform on the circle. And so that's what Fourier series are. It's a very specific instance of the Fourier transform. So the big picture, the Fourier transform is the thing that connects to tons of math. And this is one specific instance of it. And hopefully, yeah, I can give you a good idea of all the different ways you can use this. So basically, Fourier series then, a good first definition might be it's the study of how you can represent a function as a sum of waves. So you want to be able to write a function as a sum of these basic waves, so sines and cosines. Everybody's taken complex analysis? Or how many people have taken complex analysis? Okay, I don't have to use anything. I'm just going to rewrite this. So everybody has probably seen this guy. And so you'll believe me when I say I can rewrite this sum. So this is over, both of these guys are over n. I can fiddle around with this for a second and rewrite this as a sum over the integers. Maybe some different numbers that are related to these two. And e I n x. So this is the way we're going to be thinking about it. And so this is, and this was the original motivation. What functions can you write in this way? In what sense are these two things equal? Because maybe these series don't exactly converge, but maybe there's still some way that you can say that it's equal to this function. So there are a lot of interesting questions like that. We're not going to worry about all those kind of technical questions. Joseph Fourier was the first person to write anything like this down, and basically, if you can write a function like this, then you can solve the heat equation, which maybe I should actually write down because, so, you can solve this guy with this function as an initial condition, if you have this representation. And you guys probably saw this in differential equations, right? Okay, I wanted to write this down because this guy is going to play an important role. So maybe I'll just come back to that. Okay, so maybe you remember that these bn's and an's have some formulas and they involve integrals, right? So let me give you the setup of where those formulas come from. So let's begin with the definition. And do we have more chalk? Because I'm going to run out very, very quickly. Oh, cool. So a lot of you have probably seen this, but I still feel like I need to write it down. So a Hilbert space is a vector space, which is possibly infinite dimensional, along with a map into C called, you know, dot product, a Hermitian form, a sesquilinear form. There are a lot of names for it, but yeah, I'll give an example in a second. Satisfying so first thing, it's not quite symmetric, but if I want to flip it, then I just get the complex conjugate. So maybe I'll. Second thing, it's linear in the first argument, and then very close to linear in the second argument. So alpha x plus beta y. Thanks, man. Oh, sorry. So linear in the first argument. And then in the second argument, I get out complex conjugates. And that's just because of this. And there's one last condition, and it's, oh, well, one more thing, actually. It's positive definite. And I have equality if and only if x is 0. One last thing. So this is a complete definition of just an inner product space. But to be a Hilbert space, I also require it to be complete with respect to, so that this is a norm, maybe it's not entirely obvious, but you could work through it. The square root of V paired with itself. And just like a quick check, this is real because if I flip it, I get its complex conjugate, but that should be the same thing. Okay, so I require that HB is complete with respect to this norm. And does everybody remembers what complete means? Cauchy sequences converge? Okay, cool. Okay, so let me maybe do a few examples. So, example one, easy example, just n copies of C. So if I want to know what the inner product is, take a vector, and this is just multiply the coordinates and sum them up, except in the second one, take a complex conjugate. And this is something everybody's probably seen before. So if I replace the W's with Z's to check what the norm would be, then this would become, so, and that looks like the norm that we're used to, so. Second example, maybe more important example, for at least for our purposes, and for a lot of other purposes. So little l2 of z is how you would say this. And this is going to be, so these are sequences indexed by z. So this is the indexing set, so you could put other things here. Such that and I'll tell you maybe what this means if you haven't seen it before. I can sum up their moduli squared and get something finite. You probably haven't seen indexes over Z before. It doesn't mean anything more complicated than over N. It just means that if I started at negative R and go up to R, then these guys are a Cauchy sequence and converge to something. And that would be the definition of what that infinite sum is. And I mean, so just if I replace Z with, say, a finite set of N things, then I just get back this guy. So this is maybe a more general version of this. But this is, anything else I want to say about this? Does everybody get the definition of this? I guess one thing that I do want to say is, oh, I haven't told you what the inner product is yet. but it's probably, or at least shouldn't be entirely obvious that this is even a vector space. So one thing I would need to convince you of is that, to convince you this is a Hilbert space, one thing I would definitely need to say is that it's a vector space. So I need to convince you that I can add two things and still get something that's square summable. So that's something that I'm not going to do, but look up. And you've probably seen this in different guises before. Cauchy-Schwarz inequality, so that's how you would do that. I would also need to convince you that this, so this is going to be my inner product. So if I take in two sequences, I'm going to do exactly what I did here. The only difference is going to be an infinite sum. So that this is an inner product, I can just argue by analogy, this guy's an inner product, so that is too. It's not obvious that this is always going to be finite, but once again, look up the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality, it is always finite, so it's okay. And so we're going to be coming back to this later. This is a very important example. Yeah, so to convince you, I mean, it looks obvious, but if I wanted to convince you that this guy was actually infinite dimensional, then I would need to write down an infinite basis, right? And obvious basis for this would be, so zeros. So just put a 1 in the ith slot and zeros everywhere else. And then this is definitely going to be a basis for this guy. It's obvious that these guys are linearly independent just because if you add them or anything, the coordinates don't interact. Yeah, the addition's just coordinate wise. And so maybe, yeah. And one interesting thing about these guys is that if I look at EI paired with EJ, what am I going to get out? Yeah, 0 if I put in two things that are different, 1 if I put in the same thing. And so this is actually called an orthonormal basis for the Hilbert space. It's a basis. So let me maybe make this a definition. This is something that you can find in any Hilbert space. And so an orthonormal basis is, well, it's a basis. But so it's a basis over whatever your indexing, you know, however big your space is, such that that happens. So they're orthogonal, meaning that if you plug in two different guys, you get out 0. And they're normalized, meaning if you compute the norm of any of them, you get 1. Because remember, the inner product is just the norm squared. And so, yeah, and you guys have probably seen this before, but an important property, or the reason you would want to write this down in the first place is because it makes everything easy to do, right? So if I just took a vector, this is a basis, so I know that I can write it. I'm not going to worry about the indexing set. I know I can write it like this. Well, how do I figure out what the numbers are? Well, I can take the inner product of V with EI. So this is just kind of a simple exercise, but and if I write V like this, well, maybe I should pick J here. With EJ, then just use the basic properties of the inner product like linearity and everything, and I get out sum AI EI EJ, but this is 0 most of the time and 1 exactly when J and I are the same, so I just get out AJ. So all the coefficients are really just inner products of V with the EIs. And that makes doing anything very, very, very easy. So using that observation, I can also look at the norm of V. Once again, just use basic properties. So I won't write everything. So using linearity in the first coordinate, and then conjugate linearity in the second coordinate, and then using the fact that this guy's an orthonormal basis, the only times that, I can collapse this double sum into a single sum, and I get out this. And so, and remember, I didn't start with a little L2 space. I just started with an arbitrary Hilbert space, wrote this as a sum. But so you can see that I have a map from H. So in this case, let's say that everything was happening over Z. Then I would have a map from H to this guy, right? By just taking a vector here, writing its coordinates in terms of the orthonormal basis, and then sending those coordinates over here. So, like in this case, for the V's, V would just go to this sequence. This sequence isn't, yeah.
Why is it L2? What's
the 2 stand? The 2, that's a really good question. The 2 stands for the fact that I'm taking their squares and summing them. So this is actually a specific case. I could put a P there for P between 1 and up to infinity. Yeah. So that's a good question. The only one of these, though, that's a Hilbert space is this one. And that's basically because norms that come from inner products have very special properties. And so you could just show that these guys don't have those special properties except for when P is 2. And so since all the norms here are finite, just because when I send them over, I know I actually do get something in L2 of Z because I can do this argument. And it turns out that this is actually onto any sequence. That's, I guess, obvious, actually. Any sequence, right? I could just tack those coordinates on, and I get out a vector. And so this is maybe something part of a big theorem, which we basically discussed just now how to prove. It's really easy, called the Riesz-Fischer theorem, that every Hilbert space looks something like this, where you put an indexing set here. Okay, we are going to use just the fact that the norm is equal to the sum of squares of the coefficients later. Okay, next thing we need to talk about before we actually get to the Fourier stuff. Are self-adjoint matrices. So yeah, so I'm going to go back down to the finite dimensional world. So we're just going to look at Cn. And maybe I'll give a definition, then we can talk about it. So a self-adjoint matrix is a matrix. It needs to be invertible. It has complex entries such that A, so this is all notation for this, A is equal to its conjugate transpose. So if I take the transpose and then I conjugate all the entries, I get A back. It seems maybe just like a random quirky thing, but it's actually very, very, very important. Um, So everybody's taking linear algebra. So you know that I can think of all the matrices in here as maps. So in this case, from Cn to Cn, right? I could take a vector, multiply the matrix with the vector, and I get out another vector. And it's a linear map. It's invertible because that's how I picked it. But the important point here, well, maybe I'll do an example and then tell you what the important point is. So here's a matrix. I can transpose it. And the only thing that happens when I transpose it is I flip these two guys. But then when I take its conjugate, the signs go back to what they were. So this guy's self-adjoint. Maybe more importantly, though, so A, E1, where E1, maybe I won't write it that way, A of the vector 1, 0 is just this column. So I get out the vector 3, negative I. This is, I guess, not the right way to write this, but I should write it like this. A of 0, 1, so the second vector, I get out I3, right? That's just what the columns are telling me. But maybe the important thing to notice is if I take the vector 3, negative I, so that's this guy, and I take its dot product with the vector 0, 1, then multiply these two guys, I get 0. Multiply these two guys, I get negative I. So that's not particularly interesting or anything. But if I do the other way around, so I look at and now A, so here's what I'm trying to compare. This remember that in the second coordinate, it's conjugate linear. So I don't get out I when I do this. I actually get out negative I. So I get out the same thing. And this is the important point of self-adjoint matrices. The point is that for a self-adjoint matrix, I always have, so if I apply A to this side of the inner product, it's the same thing as applying it over here. So I can flip it back. And this is, you can go through the computation and prove this by just like writing out what matrix multiplication is in terms of dot products and then playing around with it. But this is really important. So a very, very important observation is that if I do this, so if I look at B and then it's image under A, I can flip this. I get B complex conjugate, but because A is self-adjoint, that's the same thing as putting it over here. So this is B AV, and so that tells me that this guy is actually always real for every vector. And that's, I guess, an important observation in like when you do Schrodinger equation stuff. Like that's, if you ever do anything with Schrodinger equations, everything is required to be self-adjoint basically with that. And some other stuff. Okay. So a big theorem that you probably didn't hear called this, and it was probably a boring theorem when you first learned it, is something called the spectral theorem. And it says that, so in this situation, the finite dimensional situation, it says that if I have a self-adjoint matrix, so if I have a self-adjoint matrix, then there exists an orthonormal basis
Do you guys, everybody remember what eigenvalues are? Maybe I'll write it down and I'll just, I mean, it's simple. So then there exists an orthonormal basis such that, well, I should have written. So given a self-adjoint matrix with these eigenvalues, not necessarily distinct, then there exists an orthonormal basis such that A, E, I is lambda I, E, I. So this is the definition of an eigenvalue and an eigenvector, right? It's just a vector that is stretched by the matrix. And the fact that this is true is actually way deeper than it seems when you first learn it. This is, you probably learned it as saying that self-adjoint matrices can be unitarily diagonalized. So if I, this says that if I write down this matrix, then I can change the basis to this basis, and on this basis, A just looks like a diagonal matrix. And by our observation over there, all of these entries are actually real. All the eigenvalues of a self-adjoint matrix are real. One way of thinking about this is it says that for a self-adjoint matrix, I can find a basis on which that matrix just looks like multiplication. And this is a theorem that, if you look up spectral theorem, is like one of the foundations of Schrodinger equation theory and everything in quantum mechanics. So, and we're going to use this in a second. Yeah, the point of all this is I'm trying to build up and get to a kind of natural definition of a Fourier series instead of just saying, oh, here's a thing. We could play with it. Okay. And so we could go back to this example. I won't do the computations, but maybe I'll just remind you of the what we would need to do. So I would need to find all the roots of this polynomial. That would tell me what the eigenvalues are. You guys probably remember this. And they're going to end up being, I think, 2 and 4. And then we would just need to solve the corresponding. Let me just look at what I had written down. Yeah, and then we would just need to solve the corresponding matrix equations. Figure out what a vector is that does this. And if we just did this for each of these guys, we would find the vectors 1, I, and 1, negative I. So these guys aren't normalized. They don't have norm 1. But if we took their inner product, we would definitely get 0. That's just kind of a computation. Okay. So now I'm going to start maybe relating it to this guy. So, if you guys remember in Diffie-Q, you saw systems of ODEs that look like this, right? And the way you solve these systems, you look at this matrix, you find its eigenvalues, and then you put them inside of exponentials. And that's basically how you solve these. Okay, so now let's maybe go to this guy. So a little caution you might remember, just it's just taking two derivatives, right, on the diagonal. So no mix partials. Since what we're thinking about, what we're about to think about is just going to be one-dimensional stuff, I mean, this is, in the case of one dimension, just taking two derivatives, just in case you haven't seen Laplacian, it's nothing more than that. So let's see, actually I need to introduce a Hilbert space first, where the Laplacian acts. And then maybe the goal is I'll give you kind of a rough argument that the Laplacian is actually self-adjoint, tell you what its eigenvectors are, and then by analogy with this, that's exactly where Fourier series come from. So the appropriate space, so I'm going to call this definition and theorem, so I'm just going to claim that it's a Hilbert space. So this is a different L. So this is the space of complex value functions such that this integral is fine. So it looks exactly the same as the other little L2 space. It's like a continuous version of that. So I would need to tell you that, so this is the square of the norm. And by analogy, again, with little L2, you might believe me that this is an inner product. And it turns out that it is, and under some kind of technical things, you can show that this guy is complete with respect to this, etc. So this, I guess, this is a definition, and the theorem is that this is actually a Hilbert space. Any questions so far about anything? Okay, so let's maybe look at this guy. So you prove, or you think about in Calc 1, this, you know, taking derivatives is linear. So this is a linear operator for sure. We might have to worry a little bit about the fact that if I take a function in here that's squared integral, and I take two derivatives, maybe it's not square integral anymore. Like an example of a function that would be in here. That guy's in there. But maybe 1 over x. So 1 over x is not in here if 0 is in this interval, then 1 over x won't be. So that square thing is just picking up like how bad singularities are. And this singularity is too bad to work. But so you see that if I maybe take some derivatives, I'm not necessarily going to land back in this space. So there are some domain things you have to worry about. And just to drop a word so the right domain that we're going to be looking at without saying it is something called a Sobolev space. So this is just something else. So it's H2 of this guy. So that's something you might, that's a very analytic thing that you might think about. But without worrying about that, let's just look at this inner product for just some app where this works. And let's suppose also just that G is 0 in the endpoints, and its derivative is 0 in the endpoints. Well, then this is just a simple integration by parts, right? I can take one of these derivatives, put it over here, I pick up some boundary terms, but I'm not worrying about that. So I would get negative A to B, or I guess this needs to be a complex conjugate, F prime G prime. I'm taking real derivatives, so I can just bring it inside the complex conjugate. It's no big deal. Do it again. A to B, F, G double prime. So the negative goes away. The boundary terms don't matter, because I'm assuming they don't matter. And this is F, G double prime. So then you might believe me that there's a, you know, mod some technical stuff. Taking two derivatives is a self-adjoint operator on this Hilbert space L2. Okay, well, I guess I erased it. The reason I wanted to put up the spectral theorem, or one of the reasons, is it tells us that for self-adjoint things, so the appropriate generalization of the spectral theorem tells us that self-adjoint things come with orthonormal bases. And those orthonormal bases, how can you find them? Well, you need to solve an equation that looks like this. In our situation, A is taking two derivatives. We still don't know what lambda is, but we want to get back this. So this is just a simple ODE that you probably saw when you did the heat equation in the FEQ. We're not going to worry about walking through how to solve it, but this has solutions. You probably remembered them as sines and cosines in the FEQ, but in our world, everything's allowed to be complex valued, so... And lambda ends up having to be basically plus or minus n. And so I get n and z. So these guys are eigenfunctions for taking two derivatives. We can just maybe do that really, really quickly. So if I took this, took two derivatives, I'm going to get out, so e, I, n, x, I'll use this notation. Take two derivatives, I just get out I squared, n squared, function again. So that's this. So I get back a scaled version of the original function. So it is an eigenfunction, or an eigenvector. And what does the spectral theorem tell us? Well, it tells us that these guys, so if I can find the eigenvectors, then it tells us that they're orthogonal. So I get for free, not that this is hard to show, but that if I take their inner product, I get zero if n and m are the same. I haven't normalized them. I'm not going to worry about that right now. So they don't have norm 1, so I don't get out the Kronecker delta. I get out scaled version of it, but it also tells me that for all f in this space, I can write f as an infinite linear combination of these guys, and this is exactly Fourier series. It also tells me what the formula for these guys are. Because we know that these guys form an orthonormal basis, and so the ans are just f paired with this guy. And what is this? This is f of x. And so I take the complex conjugate of this, that just puts a negative right there. So e to the minus I and x dx. And if you break this up into sines and cosines, you'll get back the formula. Actually, this is right. But because I didn't normalize them, so they don't have norm 1, I pick up 1 over the length of A of B, just because I didn't normalize them. So that's that. In DIPQ, you kept having to deal with those 1 over 2 L's all over the place, and that's where they're coming from. Another thing that this all tells us is that if we take... So once again, I'm going to have a weird factor floating around. And let me just work on an interval negative A to A's to make everything look a little bit nicer instead of A to B. It all works fine. But it also tells me, remember, if I want to compute the norm squared of a vector, then I could take its coefficients and sum their squares. And because I have all this normalization stuff, I'm worrying about 1 over... I have to worry about the 1 over 2A. But... So it tells me that the L2 norm of a function is the same thing as the little L2 norm of its Fourier coefficients. And this is all just basic applications of Hilbert space theory. And is there anything else that I need to say? No. Okay. So are there any questions about any of this yet? So basically, what have we done? So, more or less by analogy with the self-adjoint matrix case, looking at this guy, we found the space where this operator was self-adjoint. We found an orthonormal basis on which this operator looks like multiplication. And we just said, okay, we can write all functions with respect to this orthonormal basis. And that's exactly where Fourier series comes from. It comes from this process of diagonalizing these differentiation operators. Another interesting fact, the fact that only discrete lambdas are allowed here, so my indexing set isn't like R or something, it's integers. This is where the word quantum comes from in quantum physics. You probably do that in your first like quantum mechanics class or whatever, you solve these equations, but it's basically a statement about the discreteness of the spectrum of this operator. Okay. So that's the setup. And now, so in the last like five minutes, I'm gonna do an application of this. So maybe up to this point it just kind of seems like you're doing stuff, but it turns out this is all highly non-trivial. So you probably remember from Calc 2 things that look like this, right? Geometric series. They're convergent if this guy has absolute value less than 1. There's a formula for what they sum to. It's A over 1 minus R. Seems boring at the time. But this turns out to be virtually only situation where you can take an infinite series, say, okay, it's definitely convergent, and here's a formula for what it sums up to. Otherwise, it is literally an impossible problem. And this is kind of silly, but also not entirely inaccurate. Maybe you guys have seen things that look like this before. I can't do zetas, but... So the Riemann zeta function is basically a question about... So you know that this thing sums up. That's an easy first thing you would learn if you studied this guy. But just knowing just when it sums up to 0 is a million-dollar question. So these are absurdly hard problems. And so my little application of all this is just going to be s equal to 2. Doesn't equal 0. So it actually equals pi squared over 6. So we're going to prove that n going from 1 to infinity, 1 over n squared, definitely convergent by the p-series test, right? Seems maybe unimportant and silly, but it turns out, I mean, in and of itself, maybe not an interesting fact, but the fact that you can actually write down in closed form what this sum is like highly not trivial. And this problem was actually posed in, I think, 1644 or something like that. I don't know why someone asked the question, but they did, and it took 90 years for anyone to solve it. And when Euler solved it 9 years later, he didn't use the technique I'm about to show. He used some kind of non-rigorous, like, fudging around with the power series of sine. And he looked at this guy. I can show you afterwards if you want. He looked at this guy and he said, well, this guy has roots at plus or minus n pi. So if it was a polynomial, I could factor it. So he factors it into a big infinite product and then also writes down the Taylor series and then compares coefficients and gets out this guy. We're going to prove it using Fourier series. And it's actually it's really simple. So, Fourier series work in this space. X is a function in this space, so it has some Fourier coefficients. I can compute them. So first thing, a0 is the integral from negative pi to pi of x dx. Because when I plug in 0 into exponential h, I get out 1. X is odd, so I don't even have to worry about it. I get out 0, because it's a symmetric interval. And then, other than that, I can compute an. Sorry, there should be 1 over 2 pi's everywhere. That's going to be important because I'm trying to get out this exact number. So let me make sure I don't mess that up. So x e to the negative I in x dx. So just do integration by parts once. So 1 over 2 pi minus 1 over IN. So you guys, and if you haven't done anything with complex exponentials before, I mean, just do what you would do if it wasn't a complex exponential, and that would be fine. So x e to the minus pi and x from negative pi to pi minus this guy. Maybe I won't bore you with the rest of the computation, but if you write this out in terms of sines and cosines, or just, I mean, it goes to zero. And then the other term, and this is actually a computation you probably did in DiffDQ, you just didn't know you were doing it. 1 over 2 pi minus 1 over IN. And let's see, get it out. So I just get out this. But if you look at this for a little while, so factor out the pi, then this is a complex number plus its conjugate. So you get out twice its real part, right? So twice its real part will cancel with that. I get this. Twice the real part of this guy is sine. So sorry, that's not right. It's cosine n pi. Cosine n pi is negative 1 to the n. So I get negative 1 to the n plus 1 over I n. And so, and yeah. Okay, so these are the Fourier coefficients. So what did we just show? We just showed that x can be written, not zero, as negative 1 to the n plus 1 over I n times e to the I n x. And we know that if we take the squares of these coefficients and sum them up, we should get the L2 norm of x, which is just computing the integral of x squared, and that's really easy to do. So I guess maybe we'll do it over here. So, from negative pi. So we get back 1 over 2 pi times the L2 norm, if you remember. X squared dx. So 1 over 6 pi. Because this guy's even, I can just double it on this interval. And so I get back 1 over 3 pi x cubed from 0 to pi. But that's just pi cubed over 3 pi, pi squared over 3, and pi squared over 3 needs to be the sum of squares of all those guys. So this is n. And if you take the absolute value of those guys, I mean, you just got 1 over n squared, the 6 comes in because I'm actually summing up over z, right? It's 2 copies of n. So I get 2 sum 1 over n squared, 1 to infinity, bring the 2 over. So, just kind of silly calculus computations, but the highly, highly non-trivial part is making this statement. And that's all, that's everything that goes into there is all the Hilbert space stuff that we talked about before. But then afterwards, it's just computation. And you could play around with this. I mean, just pick any random function who has a finite integral when you square it. Compute its Fourier coefficients, take their absolute value, square it up, and you can kind of just get out tons of little things like this that maybe don't mean much, but are actually really hard problems in and of themselves. So that's it. If you have anything else you want to ask me, feel free to come up afterwards, and yeah, I can tell you about it.
Anybody have any questions?
Fourier series? I mean, when we're...
You said option. Who was it that proved it first?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't actually know who proved this specific thing using Fourier techniques. It wasn't Fourier himself. It was someone later on after they had... Yeah, I don't actually know who wrote that one down first, though. That's a good question. Anybody else?